friends, and welcome into this edition of Informed Utah. This is part of the JMAC podcast. But on Informed Utah, we'll dive into issues that uniquely face us here in the state of Utah. And I've got a lot of things coming up, really cool things. We're going to be talking to experts about the drought and water usage. We're going to be talking to local mayors about the drought issue and things that we can do. We're also going to be talking to the state epidemiologist later this week to talk about her recommendations to Utah schools. So we've got a lot coming up, but we'll start out with an introduction to somebody who I met several months ago, and he has announced himself as a candidate for Congress in the 4th Congressional District. In fact, he's announcing today, and I have butterflies in my stomach having gone through what he is going through. And so I had the chance to sit down with him and to just get some, you know, just get a feel and a flavor for who he is and what motivates him. And he's promised that he'll come back on the show. We didn't have enough time today to really deep dive into the issues, but he's committed to come back on the show live and to take your questions. For now, just consider this an introduction to Jake Hunsaker, who is running in the 4th District as a Republican against Burgess Owens. All right, Jake, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm just curious what type of emotions you're going through as today the world knows that you've decided to jump into the arena and run for Congress in the 4th District.
Well, Jay, thank you so much for having me. It is a pleasure to see you again. We've spoken a few times, and let me say this first of all. I have so much respect for the kind of campaign that you ran last year in this same primary and a lot of the things that you focused on, the issues that need to be solved for, the rhetoric that we want and should expect from our leaders and our representatives. You embodied all of that, and I'm just thrilled to be here, first of all.
Oh, so you're very kind.
A little bit starstruck is, I guess, the first one. And then the second one I would say is really just energized. You know, there's been a lot of, and of course, a lot of work goes into getting a campaign off of the ground. I'm a political outsider and I have never encountered any of this before, but I've learned a lot already and we're just at the beginning. And even just getting this out the door, you know, filing today, declaring my candidacy is so monumental. And I feel like, you know, the sky's the limit. And I also believe there's so much room for this type of a dialogue and this type of a message. I think it's really going to resonate. So I'm very hopeful and excited.
Well, good. I'm glad you're excited. You're in the early stages. What I do want people to know about your platform and why you decided to run. But before we get into that, let's help people get to know you a little bit. Tell us about your history. What do you do for a living? That type of stuff.
Yeah, well, I am from a family of 11 children west of Ogden. I know. That's quite a large number. And I am at the bottom end of that family. So I have a twin. We are the youngest. And my siblings all carried on the tradition. So I have like 70 nieces and nephews. I think it might be 71. And then we have like, you know, I think three more on the way in the next month or so. So as you can imagine, there are always a lot of people around, and when you have opinions, you learn to talk loudly, which is part of the problem and one of the reasons I'm here today, right? So I came, you know, I was raised in agricultural Utah. My first jobs were picking corn in the late summer, sweet corn, and milking cows on the weekends at the dairy farm down the street. And I just really, I grew up in kind of this Americana community that all pitched in to help one another when there was a need, that instilled in me and in my siblings this sense of real moral grounding and, you know, the idea that community and family matters much more than anything that happens, you know, back in Washington, as long as they can get out of the way. And that really has stuck with me. So I come from that heritage, and I'm very proud of it and thankful for it. And also, you know, as a now I'm a my own person and I'm a professional. I do business analytics and operations management in the private sector, which I think actually lends to very nicely to the problems that we need to solve for today legislatively. But we can get to that later. So Really, you know, that's what informs who I am and what my principles are, what my philosophy is.
Very good. So you're a business professional, you grew up in this huge family, you're definitely from, you know, from the meat and potatoes part of Utah for sure.
Yes. I'm
just curious what it is that has sent you in this direction. Why have you decided to throw your life into turmoil, speaking from experience, and throw your hat in the ring to run for Congress?
Yeah, well, a little bit informally, I will say that it is turmoil, right? You know, anyone can do this, and everyone who thinks they have good ideas should consider doing this, because that's the nature of the democracy that we live in. The idea that any concerned person, you know, across the country can step forward at any time and say, I think we can do better, or I think I have an idea that might help here, or, you know, even engage in conversation. So I first of all think, you know, politics in and of itself is a wild ride, and it will be a little bit tumultuous. But I also feel so strongly that anyone who believes they have a better way should step forward and make their case. And as far as where we are today, and why I decided that now is the moment to make that case, it is not a question anymore whether the Republican Party is or is not in a moment of identity crisis. You know, we have come to a place where the party, I believe, is fairly reactive instead of proactive. We take our cues from, you know, what's going to get the most clicks, what's going to be the most sensational, what's going to be, you know, the most simple, pithy soundbite, and we run that direction. And I very seldom see leaders in, across the aisle, but I'm Republican, and so that's most concerning to me, in the Republican Party who are willing to engage in complex, difficult, nuanced conversations about the direction that we need to go as a country and how to solve these problems. And you know, of course, that's come to a head over the last couple of years. And certainly this year, when we saw, you know, at the Capitol building, the fruits of those oversimplified, extreme sound bites and polarizing rhetoric, that all of a sudden we thought, oh, you know, one of the things I learned on the farm and from the Bible is that you reap what you sow. Mm. Well, sometimes in politics, we end up reaping what we sow. And that's the moment that we're at as, you know, as a nation. And so there's never been a better time to try and make, our voices heard as concerned voters.
Yeah, very good. So then I'm curious, specifically, you've decided to run as a Republican in the 4th District in a Republican primary against Burgess Owens. I have to assume that means that you don't like the job he's doing, or you disagree with his approach. What is it that made you say I can be a better choice than Burgess Owens?
Well, listen. Oh, my dog just started eating food.
That's
right
okay.
Now. And so you're going to hear some crunching in the meantime. So let me say this: I believe that Burgess Owens is, you know, a great person. In fact, I was at a dinner with him last weekend. And, you know, he's friendly, he's amiable, he's approachable. And I have no doubt that he's fine, you know, as a person. But what I do also believe is that you have to be more than a nice person in order to fairly represent the difficulties and the challenges that we're trying to combat, both in Washington and here at home and as a nation, right? I would vote with Burgess Owens very likely 90% of the time or more. We're both conservative, we're both Republican. But what I won't do is not use, you know, I won't take my talking points or my task list or my vote list from, you know, a third party source. And by third party, I mean like just someone else, right? We need critical thinkers that are going to go through issue by issue and determine how they feel about that issue and what best represents the interests of their voters at home. And I don't see that happening with Burgess right now. I see, you know, someone who uses the same talking points as, you know, every other oversimplified leader is using in discussions across the party. And I see a situation where he is not acting or talking as a principled conservative, but as an opportunistic politician. And that is concerning to me.
That is very interesting. You talk about engaging in discussion, in critical thought, those types of things. And you talk about the soundbite, right, where we just want kind of the rage of the moment kind of thing. One of the reasons why politicians use these tactics is because the people respond to them. We respond to them. It's almost as if we've grown to expect that, and if we don't get it, then we want somebody who brings it. So I think that there has to be a change in ourselves along the way. How do you, what is your messaging to people who have grown accustomed to that and who seem in many cases to actually appreciate it? They're like, finally, we got someone in the arena who's punching back and it feels good. What is your messaging to them?
Well, I believe very simply that America is great because America is good. And if America ever ceases to be good, America will cease to be great. Right. And I, by the way, did not coin that phrase. Okay. And part of what I think it means to be good is that we're willing to engage with people who think differently than us, with people who may not package their worldview the same way that we do, and with people who have different shared experiences, different life experiences that have led them to a place where they've come to different conclusions about the best way to approach these problems. And I believe that most people fall into this bucket, that most people are feeling disenfranchised and lost because of the oversimplification of politics. We see it in, you know, election engagement every cycle, right? Fewer and fewer voters are turning out to vote. Fewer and fewer people are engaging in their caucuses and their conventions and their primaries. And that's a problem. And I believe it's symptomatic of the fact that there's this massive, you know, gap between what's happening in the political arena and what most voters want to hear and to see from their leaders and from their representatives. And so I do believe there's room to make this case. I also believe there's a real trend right now that must be fought to, you know, take the easy swings, the easy punches, to vilify and demonize the other side and to oversimplify at the cost of progress and at the cost of the middle ground. And that's dangerous.
Yeah, I do agree that it is at the cost of progress. You and I had this discussion before. Civility, the word civility, has become a bad word. Yep. People hear that word civility, or I want to listen to the other side, or I will at least engage with the other side. And what they're hearing is weakness. They view that as oh, you're weak. You're not strong on the issues.
Right.
And I think that's one of the changes that has happened within the party. What do you have to say to people who feel that way?
Well, listen, I think that resolve is a quality, okay? And so let me be clear about, you know, I believe that politicians should be centered on what they believe and on what their constituency wants, you know, and is in their best interest. What I don't believe is that that equates to obstinance or to stubbornness or to a determination to disengage from the conversation. You know, you even look at the infrastructure bill that just passed the Senate. Now it's going to face this uphill or maybe, you know, a difficult battle in the House. We don't know how that's going to shake out. What we do know is that there were a handful of Republicans willing to engage on that bill, right? And whether you agree that that bill is the best way to approach this solution, you know, to our infrastructure problems or not, whether you vote yay or nay, the fact is that just to get to the point where we've put something forward that has bipartisan support from at least a few people, we need more of that. And you're right. Right now, the bipartisanship is a liability. It is not a strength. And when I was raised, you know, I call myself a 90s Republican, a little bit loosely, but I was raised in an era where our party had, you know, just kind of wrapped up this huge Cold War. And we have fought so hard to champion democracy, you know, around the world, and we had resolved that was what we stood for as a country, freedom for individuals around the globe. And now we've devolved into this place where it's almost like, you know, unless you toe the party line and unless you are outraged all the time at what other people think and feel, then you're not true to your beliefs. And I just don't buy into that. I think there's so much room for dialogue, and you can still be principled. You can still be resolute in your beliefs, in your tactics, but we have to have more engagement across the aisle.
Yeah, I agree. How do you do that? I mean, I talk all the time about principled opposition versus partisan opposition.
Right.
And in today's world, I feel like most things from both sides of the aisle are partisan opposition. They're about political power. They're not about principles. And I think we've lost our way principle-wise.
Yeah.
And I can tell you, having been in your shoes, the pull that you're going to experience to waver from your principles will be strong, because there'll be times when you're like, well, if I just say this or I just adjust this way, then maybe I'll get more votes or I'll get more donations. How do you stand on principle? How do you stay firm on that?
Well, that's a great question. And let me say this, people, you know, I've been asked before and I will get asked again, when who you are as a person, what you believe as a person comes into conflict with, you know, what your party says you need to be doing, you know, what are you going to do? And actually, for me, that's a very easy answer. But I want to clarify something first. We conflate in the current political dynamic the notion of party and constituency far too often. And so, you know, if party leadership says, you know, at the cost of, you know, something for your constituency, or despite what your constituency feels or thinks, you need to vote this way because it's politically expedient, to me, that's a very easy answer. And we have a few politicians that I look to on the Hill right now, you know, even in state government right now, that I believe are refreshing because they act in a way that's not beholden to anyone other than themselves and their constituency. But I will also say that there is a balance to strike between what I probably think, you know, and want personally, and what maybe a constituency wants. And then that gap needs to be filled by information. You know, if I'm a politician, I believe I have information that, you know, the constituency does not have. It's incumbent on me to educate, to engage in the community, to understand the concerns, to try and resolve those concerns through thoughtful discourse and discussion, so that ultimately I should never be that far apart from what my constituency wants. And if I ever am, that's the beauty of what we call elections, you know, the free market of elections. And so hopefully the constituency can hold me to account for that. And I believe we should do that with our elected officials.
Very good. All right. So let's get to some issues. Tell me off the top of your head, what are the most important issues for you? You're a newly elected congressman, you're on your way, and you want to make a difference. What do you focus on?
Well, Jay, there are a couple that come to mind, and I want to be very clear that I feel passionately about a few things that I think are going to be really impactful in the next decade to two decades, and no one's looking at them right now, okay? You know, I come from the tech industry sector. I've spent time in the private sectors, and I interned in Silicon Slopes in a startup that's, you know, massive. So I have seen how quickly tech grows and evolves. And we have a world in which the regulatory and ethical ambiguity of tech is growing and evolving much more quickly than our legislative reaction to it. And that's due in part to the fact that we have tenured legislators on the Hill that don't bother to try and understand the complicated issues of the tech world. It's due in part to the fact that we spend all of our time talking about hot button issues, the red meat issues that get the but don't solve the problems. But, you know, you think about intellectual property or data privacy or artificial intelligence, these are things that are growing rapidly. And my generation is going to have to cope with what they look like in 10, 20, 30 years. And no one's solving for those right now at the pace that we need them to. So that's really one of my passion points, is we got to get legislators back on the Hill that are willing, that you know what the technology is that exists, and know the terms and can engage in thoughtful discussion and debate on those things. And we don't have that right now. So I would say that's probably one of my top priorities. Another one that makes me different than historical Republican representatives is that I am part of a generation that, like it or not, believe it or not, is inheriting a world in climate change. Okay. And we don't fully understand maybe why that is. We don't fully understand how we can combat it. But I feel that it's my moral responsibility to take the facts that we do have and to try and address them. And not only that, I'm going to be part of a generation and I'm going to be, you know, hopefully someday a parent or a grandparent to generations that will have to cope with our negligence if we refuse to address this right now. So that's another issue that I care deeply about. You know, there are so many things at play with immigration and healthcare and all of these other things that are really important. And I hope that we can engage in all of those as the campaign progresses, because really everything other than red meat is getting ignored right now, in my view. And so, you know, I want and feel passionate about addressing that.
Yeah, it's another one of those things, this red meat, because those are the things that resonate with us. Those are the things that make us emotional, right? And anytime we can get emotionally charged, then we're ripe for manipulation, in my opinion. That's the way that that works. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, I believe that things have progressed to a place where the average voter feels so disenfranchised and so tired of the bickering and the polarization and the partisanship and the divisiveness, that, you know, just addressing that would be an emotional approach enough to engage a grassroots, you know, groundswell of a movement that could hopefully take us in the right direction. I have to think that people are willing to engage in this discussion. And I really feel emotional when I think about everything that's wrong, that's being exacerbated by the negligence of the leaders in power right now. So hopefully we can.
Yeah, I hope you're right. I hope you're right. You talked about the environment. One of the things that frustrates me is that we can't seem to find common ground. This is where I think that we're missing so much. I mean, we can sit here and debate all day long about whether or not climate change is man-made or not. But I would like to think we can all agree that clean air is good. Right. I would like to think that we all agree that energy independence and renewable energies are good. Right. So we could just focus on commonalities and avoid the whole debate. And if we positively impact the environment, great. Either way, we've achieved some things that we all want. This is what frustrates me. We don't ever talk about what we have that's common. We talk about what makes us extremely different. Again, to motivate the base.
Yeah. Well, side note is that, you know, it is a little bit sad that the only, you know, we've boiled it down so much. The only things we feel like we have in common are that we all breathe, you know. but let me say that I also believe, you know, this is certainly it's a bipartisan issue, and certainly we should feel strong about it across the aisle, and we will have differences in approach. But I also believe that actually solving for climate change and understanding what we need to do to combat the problems with our environment that we're facing is a conservative, you know, inherently conservative thing. We are the party of the private sector. And Jay, which sector, the public or the private, has, you know, brought more green and renewable technology to market than the other? It's the private sector. So there's no reason that we need to be naysayers when it comes to, you know, talking about new ways to find energy, renewable energy, you know, environmentally friendly markets and policy, because we are the party of the private sector, which is, you know, arguably the sector that's championing the environment the most effectively.
Yeah. And as Americans, clearly we can find solutions, and we're seeing some amazing solutions, but we get so caught up in that one question that
yes.
we can't move forward. Another polarizing issue is the pandemic. You know, we've lived in a time where historically a national crisis with good leadership would unify us. And I think of 9/11. I think of World War II. I think of past pandemics. But now, because we're so polarized, it's actually dividing us.
Yeah.
Dramatically. Where do you think that the problems are with the pandemic, and what can you do as a congressman to help resolve some of those issues?
Well, I think the fact that a crisis of this scale has divided instead of united us is a product of all of the rhetoric that we have cheaply given out and utilized over the last few decades in order for politicians to retain their power, in order for them to centralize their control. And it is very, very unfortunate to watch, because you're right. You know, I was in seventh grade during 9/11, and in the days after that, certainly we did, investigations, and there were conversations about how to prevent this from happening again. But that was not the knee-jerk reaction. The knee-jerk reaction was to come together, to unify in our mourning and in our empathy for one another, and our understanding that we're all in this together. And we have not seen that during this pandemic to the scale that I would have hoped. We need much more of that. And while I believe that the government's role is very limited in terms of what it can do, and that's what makes our country unique, I also fully believe that we, as as conservatives and as the party of Judeo-Christian values, we have to demonstrate what it is to have empathy and understanding and go out of our way to think about the impact of my own decisions on someone else in my neighborhood or in my family or in my society. And we also have not seen that. So certainly there's a better way to react personally, on an individual basis in our communities. And then, we can talk about the government's response, reaction, and its proper role later on. But let me say this, I think we're very lucky to live in a world that could get a vaccine out as quickly as it did, not only developed, but, disseminated and circulated. And I, am a firm believer that we're so lucky. We're the recipients of so many things that we're almost at a point where we don't understand what we have. We don't know the water that we're swimming in.
Well, it's one of the things that frustrates me with the Republican leadership right now is, are Republicans getting credit for the vaccine? Are they getting credit for Operation Warp Speed? They're not, because they've put themselves in this place where, for some reason, in their fight to protect civil liberties, and as a conservative, I don't ever want to take away somebody's rights if I don't have to. But for some reason, that argument isn't good enough for us. And so we feel like we have to attack the science. Yet at the same time, say, look what we did with the science. And so what I don't understand is why can't the messaging be, we're going to fight for civil liberties. We want people to make the best choice for themselves. But please, for yourself, for your family, for your nation, make the best choice possible for everybody. Yeah. That's the messaging that somehow we've missed. We feel like in order to protect a civil liberty, we have to attack the science. And people are dying because of it. And guess who's dying, Jake? It's Republicans. It's conservatives that are the ones who are not getting vaccinated, who are ending up in the hospital.
Yeah. Listen, I mean, across the board, whether it's the vaccine, the pandemic, whether it's foreign policy or trade or the economy, we have to get away from a space where we're saying one thing and acting another way, depending on what's most politically expedient. Because right now, the nation and the party and our communities are reaping the divisiveness and the toxicity that we have sown. And I say we, not having been part of that, hopefully, problem. That leaders and politicians have sown over the last couple of years. And it's a problem that I really hope to address in this campaign. And so, I know we're just at the start of a conversation, and I would love to come back anytime with you and talk more about these things, Jay. It's been a tremendous honor to speak with you.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. I do have one really important question. I was told over and over during the campaign, you cannot win if you have a beard. So,
well, then listen, you're my first pollster. So the pollsters are saying I can't win without a beard. I'm going to take it back to my team. We'll figure out, what length it should be and whether it should be there or not. Well, I'm at a slight disadvantage because, as it turns out, being a 32-year-old candidate without a beard makes you look like a 12-year-old candidate. So I got to keep it on for now, but let's revisit that.
Yeah, I was literally asked by members of the Republican Party when I went back to D.C. They're like, so, you gonna keep the beard?
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, listen, I'll be prepared. I'll be prepared.
I'll give you a chance here. And I agree with you. We'll do some deep dives more on policy as the campaign moves forward and as we get into the heat of the season. But what do you hope, kind of in summary, what do you want people to take away from you? What is the most important thing they can know about you?
Listen, I would say the number one thing you should know about me is that there's nothing special about me. And that's honestly, I think, what makes me such a unique kind of candidate for office. We've come to a place where we expect people to be steeped in, you know, the inefficiency of, you know, law degrees and legislative backgrounds and all of the, you know, inner workings of the political game in order to have any kind of say. And I don't believe that's the way this country was designed. The founding fathers were not all lawyers, right? They were scientists and doctors and farmers and physicians. They were a whole host of types of people from these, you know, struggling colonies because they believed in an idea that the best ideas come from average, ordinary people. And so I look forward to getting to know the voters here in District 4, certainly your viewers over time, I hope, and I hope they find, you know, I'm just a citizen who's very concerned and thinks we can do a lot better than we are. And I think that's going to resonate with a lot of people. I hope it does.
Well, listen, I just want to tell you that I appreciate you stepping in. You started out with a very important statement, and that is that everybody who feels like they can have an impact should be able to do this. I believe that our structure, the fundraising structure, the political structure chases away people who should be involved, who have a level of experience that can have an impact, and we chase them away. So at the very least, I hope that people will watch what you're doing and maybe think to themselves, I can do that.
I hope so too. I think, listen, it will never, ever hurt us to have more voices at the table. That's something we need desperately.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll have you back. We'll do some live broadcasts where people can ask you their questions. And then it will get very interesting.
I would love that. Listen, I'm going to prep my beard care routine for those questions, all right?
Yeah, absolutely. Jake, good luck. We'll watch the campaign, and we'll be in touch for sure.
Thank you so much, Jay. So great talking to you.
Once again, I want to thank Jake Hensaker for joining us on the program today. I hope this gave you a little bit of insight into who he is and what motivates him. As I said in the interview, running for Congress, I can say I know what he's going through. It's a huge step and a huge commitment. So whether or not you will give him your vote, I hope that you will at least appreciate his desire to make this country better. And also, as I said, I hope that it inspires you to get involved, whether it's at a local level, whether it's just with your vote, or whether it's running as a candidate. We will keep in touch with Jake. As promised, I will have him back on and we'll take your live questions and we'll follow his campaign as things heat up. Again, I got the butterflies for you, Jake, but I really want to thank you for diving in. I think that more than anything can impact lives. And then if you win, well, that will be another story entirely. Thank you again for joining us on Informed Utah. Again, lots of other things coming up later this week dealing with Utah-specific issues. Remember to join me live on the JMAC Live podcast on Tuesday and Thursday night at 9:30 p.m. You can see that on Facebook or YouTube or LinkedIn or all of the other social networks. And if you like what you hear, please take a minute and become a patron of this podcast. Go to jmcfarland.com and make a monthly donation or a one-time donation. That will help me out. We got a lot going on, a lot more coming your way, and I need your support to be able to keep doing that. With that, have a wonderful day.